You're tuned into the Kojo Namdi Show, and I'm Jen Gulbeck, sitting in for Kojo. Later in the hour, we remember community advocate Teresa Howe Jones. She's a strong voice for affordable housing and statehood in Anacostia. But first, towns on Maryland's eastern shore could be subject to regular flooding within the next two decades. That's according to a study from the Union of Concerned Scientists. As coastlines recede and tides move further inland, what are communities doing to combat climate issues? And what role do local politics and government play in maintaining their coastlines? Joining me to discuss the issue are Astrid Caldas, Senior Climate Scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Astrid, it's good to have you.
Thank you.
Joining us by phone, we have Bruce Mills, a lawyer in Virginia Beach. Bruce, thanks for joining.
You're welcome.
And we have Rona Cobell, a staff writer for the Bay Journal. Rona, it's good to have you.
Thank you.
And you can also join the conversation. What effects of climate change are you seeing in and along the Chesapeake? You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet to @KojoShow. Rona, I'd like to start with you. Regular flooding in communities in and on the eastern shore sounds pretty urgent. Where are we right now in terms of the effects of rising tides and beach erosion in the region?
Well, for a lot of places, the future is now. There is intermittent flooding. Places like Norfolk, they flood on high tides. It used to be you'd have to wait for a fairly catastrophic storm to see major flooding, but now it happens regularly. So towns like Norfolk are being inundated, and then you also have smaller communities like Saxis, Deal Island. These are communities that are low-lying, and they have a road that is their only access point that when that floods, you can't get there. So where we are is kind of in a scramble to get funding at a federal level for a lot of these places. Norfolk, I would argue, is fairly well ahead of the game, having recognized their problem and sort of banded together with the communities around it to find solutions and work with the Navy. The towns that are not as fortunate are the smaller ones that don't have the resources, don't have the infrastructure, don't have the Navy there, and they're kind of out there flooded and, you know, with their hands up asking for help, and there just isn't enough money or, frankly, will to help all of them.
And so we know that there's going to be more danger going forward, but just the kinds of issues that we're seeing now, how long have they been an issue? The kinds of flooding we see, say, with storms or really high tides now, is that a relatively new phenomenon or something that's been going on for a while?
The severity of it is new. There have always been in places like Hooper's Island and Croucheron, like down in southern Dorchester County, there have always been intermittent floods. People will say the water used to come up to the steps, and then now it comes up to the porch, and pretty soon it's going to come up to the living room. These are sort of phenomenon that have happened over time. But in the last, I would say, decade, you've had a real problem with sometimes school buses can't get up a road, and sometimes children can't walk safely outside of the bus to their home. And this is a relatively recent problem, I would say, the last 10-plus years. You're also seeing a whole lot of vegetation die. The coastal inundation, the saltwater marsh inundation on the eastern shore of Virginia means we're losing a lot of vegetation. And as we lose that vegetation, there isn't as much open land, wetlands, and kind of buffer areas to soak up the water when it floods. And so it's more likely now to go into people's houses. And so I think there has been kind of always a risk of flood if you live on the water or on the coast. But I think it's getting more severe, particularly in the areas that haven't seen the investment that places like Norfolk have.
Astrid, you were one of the authors of the study. We hear a lot about ice caps melting and sea levels rising, and that contributes to beach erosion. So tell us how that happens and what its effects are.
Well, the water of the sea is constantly against something, some land, some rock, or some sand. So as the movement of the waves hits those surfaces, there is an erosion that goes on. So it can break the rock, it can diminish the sand and carry some sand away. And as the sea levels rise, what's going to happen is that the erosion area is going to shift. So an area that had been currently eroded and that people had been dealing with for quite a long time, now that erosion is going to be further up or further inland, and new problems are going to arise. So sea level rise may actually make erosion a lot worse.
In your study, you also named names, so to speak. You listed areas that would be subject to regular flooding in the near future. What were some of those locations, and what was your initial reaction when you were compiling this data?
Well, that's the main novelty of our work. A lot of work done with sea level rise before has never named names. And we really wanted to give these communities the opportunity to prepare and know when that flood is coming. And I would highlight that, as Rona said, this kind of flooding is not that the area is going to be permanently underwater. It's going to be coming and going, but it's going to come and go so often that it's going to be disruptive. So places in the Eastern Shore like Crisfield, like Tangier Island, like Cambridge, like Oxford, a lot of areas in Somerset County and Kent County are already seeing much of this chronic inundation, as we call it. And actually, nowadays, currently, 91 communities are seeing that type of chronic inundation, and Maryland is second with 12 communities, second only to Louisiana.
So what does the Chesapeake look like in 3 decades? How does the environment change between now and then?
In 3 decades, sea level is going to be rising, depending on the scenario. It may rise up to a foot, up to mid-century, or maybe 2 feet, depending on the rate. We know that the rate can change, and the rate has been accelerating for the past few years. So what's going to happen is that a lot of the places who currently don't even deal with regular flooding or any flooding at all are going to start seeing more and more flood. So they are going to have to start thinking ahead, gathering the resources, gathering the community, and trying to figure out how they're going to deal with it and what's the best way for each community to deal with it, because for each community, there's going to be a different way to deal.
And so that really leads me into the next question. These communities are going to have to do something about erosion to deal with it. And Bruce, I want to bring you on this because last year you were involved in a lawsuit with the city of Virginia Beach. They wanted to replenish the beach in front of property that you own along the water. Can you tell us a little bit about the disagreement that you had with them?
Well, I had no disagreement with the replenishment of the sand on my property. It's just that in their rush to protect the environment, they've trampled on my property rights. They basically took my private property for the public good by a temporary injunction. So I'm all for appropriate replenishment of the beaches, but please be mindful of my constitutional property rights. That's why I objected to the city's lawsuit.
And so this isn't an issue about the environmental aspects. It sounds like you actually support the work that they want to do. It's more about how do they do that work, but also respect the procedural issues, what the law is surrounding that.
It was an overreach on the part of the city. They did not need to take on 250 feet of my lot to replenish the beach, but they thought it was a good thing to do, so they did it. So all I'm saying is just to be mindful of one's private property rights.
And where do you think the line is between respecting those private property rights but also doing what needs to be done to protect the coastline?
Well, I mean, it changes with each situation. However, if it does involve a taking, the appropriate procedure is to file an eminent domain, compensate the private property owner for taking of the land. I think it's the procedure that bothers me.
Okay, we have a lot of calls coming in. We're going to take some of those now, but if you'd like to join, you can try giving us a call at 1-800-433-8850. If you can't get through, send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or a tweet to @kojoshow. I'd like to start with Mike Tidwell in Bethesda. Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I am director of a group called the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. I'm actually calling from Norfolk. We're a regional organization. And I just wanted to make your listeners aware of the fact that there's a very elegant and bipartisan bill in the Virginia General Assembly called the Virginia Coastal Protection Act that would generate money for sea level rise protection along the entire coast of Virginia. And it would do so by going to the root of the problem. by putting a fee on carbon pollution, having Virginia join what's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative of states already from Maine to Maryland that put a fee on carbon emissions from power plants, and then use that money, this bill would use that money to invest in wetlands, redevelopment, elevating roads, and protection. And I just wanted to give a shout out to that bill, the Virginia Coastal Protection Act, and especially Delegate Ron Villanueva of Virginia Beach, who's a Republican, who's the primary patron in the House. It's a bipartisan bill. It makes sense, and it's an elegant bill. And people can learn more at ChesapeakeClimate.org.
Mike, thanks for calling in and telling us about that. Rona, do you have any comments you want to add about that bill?
I do have a comment to add, actually, and that's that I think we're sort of talking about two different and perhaps parallel tracks here. The one track is our overall reliance on greenhouse gases, our need to cut our fossil fuels, the relationship between these emissions and sea level rise. And I think bills like the one that Mike talked about are great for that. But at the same time that Virginia is considering this bill, a town called Pocosin in Virginia just decided that they were going to fill 8 acres of wetlands for development. So while you have overarching policy that's sort of addressing these big picture things, you have these daily incursions. Wetlands are our best defense, really, against sea level rise. So filling them to add more development is not getting us where we want. So you can have a state that on the one level is talking about doing the right things globally, but then on a macro level is doing exactly the opposite. And we've seen that all over Louisiana as well. I mean, we've seen these wetlands being filled. We've seen these coastal incursions. Louisiana loses, what, a football field of wetlands every day? So, I mean, at the same time, I think the local decision makers need to be aware, since it sometimes can be hard to connect Paris and, you know, Arctic ice melt to what's going on in a town like Hooper's Island. They need to be aware that, you know, when you give permits to fill in wetlands and when you approve developments in floodplains or approve roads in floodplains, that's a big contributor to the problem.
Astrid, you wanted to comment also.
Yes, I'd like to comment now that Rona mentioned this also. That's a great point, Rona. We should not encourage these current policies that perpetuate risky coastal development, and that's one of the big things that our report recommends. These filling up wetlands and everything, and Pocosin should really look at our study because it's one of the towns, the places that's going to flood early and is going to flood a lot. Another issue that I'd like to highlight that Mike mentioned, whenever several cities and towns and counties band together to get organized and to reduce greenhouse gases and to use the money in the way that he mentioned, that's a great initiative because we see that these types of initiatives that are multi-cities or multi-counties are much more successful than cities trying to go at it alone.
Okay, let's take one more call. John in Olney, Maryland.
Yeah.
You're on the air.
Yes, I just heard the man talk about respect for eminent domain. Well, as a legal matter, they can't take just a part of his thing. If they go to eminent domain, they have to take 100% of his property.
Okay.
And they will compensate him. They will pay him good money. This happened up in the Big Dig. They paid their way out of a lot of lawsuits.
So I think that case has been settled, but Bruce, you're welcome to comment on John's note there.
Well, talking about what Mike had said about the act that is being proposed in the legislature, did you know that the state legislature exempted all of a subdivision called Sandbridge Beach, I think it's 17 miles of oceanfront, they exempted it by statute from the Coastal Primary Sand Dune Act for political reasons. That doesn't sound right to me, that they should exempt all of those people but hold me, my feet to the fire.
Bruce, I think this is a good point, and you raise an issue about developers and the rules they have to face that we're going to discuss as soon as we come back from the break, but we're going to take that break now. If you're trying to call in, please keep trying. It's 1-800-433-8850. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this, and we have lots of calls that we're going to take after the break. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay tuned.
This month at WAMU, we're lifting our voices to shine a light on Black changemakers throughout American history. Some you know and some you don't, but they all change the world. Go to WAMU.org/lift every voice to learn the stories of these incredible African-American changemakers and to hear special interviews spotlighting those who have impacted the arts, sciences, sports, and activism. Go to WAMU.org/lift every voice.
Welcome back. I'm Jen Gulbeck, sitting in for Kojo. We're talking about rising sea levels and coastal erosion with Astrid Caldas, Bruce Mills, and Rona Cobell. You can also join the conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-433-8850. Rona, there's obviously lots of disagreement at the national level about how to handle environmental issues, but it seems that everyone in the region agrees that the Chesapeake's and its beaches need help. So what kind of discussions are we seeing at the local level in terms of how to handle these issues, and how does that differ from the national level discussion?
That's a great question. At the local level, people aren't talking about Arctic ice melt, and they're not talking about ice flows and Greenland. They're talking about, how do I get the water out of my yard? The water used to come up to the steps, and now it's up to the porch, and now twice a month it seems to be, you know, getting close to my basement. How do I fix this? Or, you know, every storm we're losing more land, how do we fix this? So in my reporting on the Eastern Shore, where I frequently am, I don't really engage people in discussions about, well, what do you think is causing climate change? I feel that it's not productive to really debate the causes like they do on the national level. What's really productive is to talk about the solutions. If this community wants to stay here for the next 100 years, first of all, is that practical? And second of all, how do we make that happen? And so on the local level, there's some very difficult questions to answer. I mean, at first, there's the question of federal money. The Army Corps of Engineers is very involved. They build the seawalls and the levees. And then NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, provides coastal planning money. And then, of course, the EPA looks over the whole environment. And all of those agencies that I just mentioned, plus many more, are undercut. So it's unclear how much money is coming. And then the other problem is that a lot of the most vulnerable communities, which Astrid spoke about in her report, referencing some earlier work that we did at the Bay Journal, a lot of these communities are unincorporated, and they're African American, and they're already on the lowest land that was available to them at the time of purchase in the 1700s or 1800s. And so they're very vulnerable, and because they're not incorporated as a city or a town, there's no way for NOAA to give them money. And so this idea of partnering with other places is quite favorable, because you can then get some assistance if you're partnering with a town or an entity that is able to receive the money. So most of the local discussions are really about how do we fix the problem, not what caused the problem.
And Bruce, as a local resident, what do you want to see in the way that Virginia Beach is having these conversations with the community about how to handle these issues?
Was that a question for me?
It is, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, of course, I'm somewhat biased in this regard. I just think let them do whatever they have to do to correct the situation, but please honor my private constitutional rights. Don't trample on my constitutional rights in order to implement an environmental regulation.
Let's take a call now from Alec in Frederick, Maryland. Alec, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. I went to ODU and went to their ocean, got a major in ocean earth sciences, and every single time it rained, it seemed we always had classes canceled because Hamilton Boulevard would just flood. And my question, and, I've been working on the beaches doing beach reclamation, especially in Virginia Beach, and it seems like every 3 years we're going to be redoing the beaches all over again. And I was curious as what the local government and, working with the Army Corps of Engineers is thinking about, how are we going to constantly be refilling the beaches? Are we going to need to raise the roads? Like, what is the general plan for Norfolk and that area?
Astrid, you immediately wanted to jump in on this one.
It was just interesting, thank you, that you mentioned ODU, because Old Dominion University is doing pilot studies on sea level rise, and it's kind of the forefront on the studies for the Hampton Roads area about sea level rise. So about beach nourishment or beach replenishment, as you know, can be called different things. Sometimes it is the only thing that's available because it's a beach, but beach nourishment is ranked 6 in terms of cost effectiveness in a study that was done on the economics of coastal adaptation by the Nature Conservancy and the Swiss Reinsurance. And ahead of beach nourishment is wetlands restorations, wetlands conservation, and reefs and oyster reefs and other areas that could be beyond the beach. So whenever a beach has some area beyond it that can't be built up or restored to prevent the erosion that's going to happen on the sand, that's a good way of dealing with it and reduce the need for replenishment every 3 years, as he mentioned.
And Rona, this ties into a lot of discussions that we have in other parts of discussing the Chesapeake Bay and environmental issues. There's a lot of work to be done on those sorts of things, both in the bay and on the shore, in terms of things like reefs and rebuilding that structure.
Right, and I think, you know, what we're trying to do is sort of multi-purpose restoration. So, like, New York City is a really good example. They have this project called the Billion Oyster Project, and they're trying to get 1 billion oysters into Jamaica Bay. And it is not so that New Yorkers can eat oysters, but so these oysters, which oyster reefs used to be in Jamaica Bay, and when they were, you didn't have storms like Sandy, which pummeled the areas that used to be, that had been filled over time. Because the water, and Norfolk is a perfect place to see this, the water will go where the water wants to go, where it's historically gone. And just because you've paved a road over a stream doesn't mean the stream is going to respect that. So, you know, I think the idea of ODU in Norfolk as kind of a living lab, and they've done some fantastic work on sea level rise, and they can really just go out right outside their door and do tests and look at things. But yeah, I think we have to get to a point, because we just don't have enough money to do everything, where we look at projects that have multiple purposes, such as oyster restoration and reefs, and putting them in places where you know the community is also vulnerable to sea level rise. And the Army Corps has done that with the Dredge Islands in Maryland, where they've replenished an island, both because they need to get rid of the sediment that they're using to dredge the Baltimore port, and then they're also creating a habitat. So I think we're continuing to look for these sort of double, triple benefit projects with the taxpayer money.
Well, that really highlights another issue, which is whether or not there's a disconnect between environmental concerns and personal concerns. Because what you were just saying suggests that these things can work together. But do you see that there's a disconnect in how those separate parts of the issue are being addressed by local governments?
I see a disconnect between the local level and the national level. At the national level, I see a lot of shouting about climate change, about fossil fuel funds, about, you know, we're on this side, you're on that side, a lot of name calling. On the local level, I do think that people may not entirely understand what is causing what they're seeing, but there's a universal, I think, agreement, and Astrid maybe has her own view from her work, that we got to do something about it, that this cannot continue. We cannot continue to live in a community that floods, you know, every other week on the tide cycle. We cannot continue to check an app on our phone to figure out where to park our car to make sure it doesn't flood. We have to make a change. And, you know, what of the options is available to us is the most cost-effective, the easiest, you know, the one that's going to work the best. That may be the argument. But the argument to me is not, do we do something? It's, you know, what of these things do we do?
Well, Astrid, do you think policy focuses too much on environment and not enough on people?
Well, there is the issue of the people do not get engaged enough. And that's another thing that we highlight in our report, that the communities have to come together with the policymakers and the decision makers and their elected officials and decide what's best for each community, because each one is going to have two or three things that they can do that will address their particular problem. As Rona said, the oyster reefs may be good for one area, but may not be viable in another area. So these things have to be tackled at the city, the town, and the community level. And I think the more we encourage these types of town halls and connections, results are going to be much better.
Let's take a call now from Moses in Annapolis. Moses, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My comment was, considering that sea rise is known to be occurring and will, and although we do not know what the height of that rise will be by the end of the century, some estimates have been as high as 6 to 9 meters. Why are we spending money trying to protect a coastline that's not going to be there? Why are we starting to move people away from the coastline?
Well, Moses, I see you're in Annapolis. Are you moving?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm looking at property in Wisconsin.
Oh, Moses, I grew up in northern Illinois, about 5 miles from the Wisconsin border. You may want to have a talk with me about the winters before you do that. Bruce, how about you? You going to move out of Virginia Beach?
No, I was born and raised here, so I plan to stay right here.
Well, Astrid, this raises an issue, right? Both in terms of, you know, do we move away? Do we focus on the infrastructure? But there's also kind of a class issue here. A lot of people, while it's great that Moses can move to Wisconsin if he wants to, a lot of people cannot afford to move out of these houses, these communities where, you know, like Bruce, they have lived their entire lives. That's where their wealth is. That's where their whole life is, right?
Exactly. And that comment, thanks, highlights the issue that many of the socially vulnerable communities will need innovative initiatives coming from the federal government down to help them cope with the issues. And because, as was mentioned, we don't know how much the sea level is going to rise, we have to work with the range. And this range, I always say, is the risk we have to prepare for. So if you have low risk, if there is a park, if there is something that can be flooded, that thing can take into account a lower level of sea rise. But if there is something that is very high risk, like a hospital, then you have to take into account a higher one. But in our report, we do not shy away from the word retreat. And in many cases, some communities and some people and some business are going to have to retreat because there's not going to be a way to protect them from the water that is coming.
Let's take a call on a related issue from Thomas in Norfolk. Thomas, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a fellow working on sea level rise and flooding solutions with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation here in Hampton Roads, Virginia. So I'm promoting natural solutions that can help mitigate the impacts of sea level rise, solutions like living shorelines that can help with coastal erosion and rain gardens that help with our overwhelmed stormwater infrastructure that's now unfortunately underwater at higher tides very, very frequently. So these practices can both mitigate recurrent flooding and help reduce pollution going to the bay. I was wondering if your guests could discuss how installing green infrastructure like this under the Chesapeake Clean Water Blueprint can help address some of the threat of sea level rise.
Well, Thomas, I got to say that Astrid in the studio was silently cheering your comments as you were giving them. So, Astrid, why don't we start with you to get your response?
Sure. We always try to encourage the green infrastructures, like he was mentioning, as opposed to the gray infrastructures, which are the hard ones that are walls and
seawalls
and stuff like that, because in the long term, they pay off and they are better cost effective. The cost effectiveness is much better. And these types of infrastructure, like retention ponds and these other things that he mentioned, are actually very good. But not always these solutions are going to work. For instance, sea level rise can bring saltwater intrusion from under any protection, like in Florida, because of the type of sediments that exist there and the type of soil. So there is lots of other things that we have to be aware of, but definitely green infrastructure, whenever possible, in the long term will pay off, and we encourage that.
Rona, did you want to comment?
Just to say that I agree, and just to explain a little bit about, you know, what green infrastructure looks like. It can be a park. It can be like a retention pond. It can be a drain field. It can be kind of an area where there's pervious pavement. So that has you don't really want your house to flood, but it's maybe not so bad if the local park floods every so often and then the water recedes. And so you're basically sort of channeling the water, putting these infrastructure items where you know the flooding is going to be, and then protecting your hard structure. So I do think it's a good idea when possible. I also think the living shoreline is great when possible. And in fact, Maryland and Virginia both have laws, I believe, that strongly encourage people to put in a shoreline made of, you know, native plants as opposed to like a hard, like riprap or wall shoreline, which also is not only better for sort of withstanding the waves and helping with the erosion, but also habitat. There's a lot of little critters like fiddler crabs and other little benthic organisms that just can't live when the shoreline is all hardscaped, and they prefer when they have cattails and grass and things to hide in.
So, Bruce, you've been a lifelong resident of Virginia Beach, as you said. How have you seen this change over the course of your lifetime? Do you remember the sea levels being lower than they are now, and have you noticed a recent increase?
I'm surprised because I never thought we had a flooding problem until recently, and that's because they have developed land way out into the county that apparently wasn't properly drained. But other than those problems, I'm not consciously aware of any flooding, not in my area.
Do you think the rising tides are going to affect Virginia Beach? Because obviously you have a lot of tourists, so if the beach is covered up a lot of the time, does that impact the source of revenue for the area?
Well, it certainly would. It certainly would. So that's why it's important to keep the beaches as wide and clean as we can, but just don't take someone else's private property to do that. Without compensating them.
I have to say, you have beautiful beaches down there in Virginia Beach. It's one of the first Atlantic Coast beaches I went to when I moved out east, and I was so impressed. So I hope y'all keep them well protected. I'd like to thank all of our guests and everyone who called in for this discussion about rising sea levels and coastal erosion. Astrid Caldas is a senior climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
Bruce Mills, a lawyer in Virginia Beach. Thanks for your comments.
You're very welcome.
And Rona Cobell, a staff writer for the Bay Journal, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back after that. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.